we're hearing House Bill 5030. The Department of Human Services, seniors and people with disabilities, and this is our wrap-up presentation today. I understand that the House just adjourned a few minutes ago, which means that our House members will not be here until a lot later. And I'm sure if the Senate members hear my voice, because we were, when I left earlier this afternoon to go down to a meeting in legislative fiscal, they were still on the floor, but Senator Morris is here, so that tells me that perhaps we're out. Anyway, I think you'll find that that's going to happen quite a bit during this process, except that I am requesting that, sending a little note to them, that after this week, this coming week, the week following that, we will begin to go into work session. And as those of you who have followed the legislative process knows, that when we're in work session, we do require quorum, which means that it becomes imperative that members are here. And while we're doing overviews, that is not the case, but once we do go into work session, it is necessary. If I don't have a quorum, then I have to request sometimes maybe others come in and sit in for them, like the co-chairs. So with that, Mr. Britton.
Madam Chair and members, I have about four handouts. There's one that has already been passed out that we'll be working from today, the Senior and People with Disabilities Responses to Questions of the committee, and I think James is going to be going through that in a few minutes. I also have a prioritized list for programs of the seniors and people with disabilities cluster. You've already seen this list, but I have yet another copy of that. I have a copy of a letter to you, Madam Chair, from Bob Repine, who is the director of the Housing and Community Development Department, talking.
He was listening in when we asked the questions.
That talks about the assisted living facilities and risk of failure of those facilities given potential rate reductions. I have a brief discussion of the long-term care insurance tax credit that was requested by the committee, and I understand from James Taves that there's further information as well in this responses on long-term care insurance. And finally, I have a letter to Mr. Taves from the Secretary of State's Audit Division talking about some reassessments within performed by the area agencies on aging for persons in survival priority levels that were reduced or eliminated in the latest budget cuts. So I will hand those out with your permission.
You may hand them out. While we're waiting for senators to arrive and individuals to regroup. And I want to take this time to thank the groups yesterday who assisted me in putting together the public testimony. And I think it was very well done. And it's interesting. I told them that one of the objectives was to make certain that we had a comprehensive overview of what actually are the services inside of the senior and people with disability and those services. And I think the individuals who came to testify yesterday presented enough information that members who aren't familiar with the various programs have a better understanding of when we talk about the issue of who's involved when we talk about the disability population as well as the senior population. So I just want to thank you publicly, because I know that how much effort goes into getting people into the building to testify.
Especially this group.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
I would just like to say that the testimony that we heard was so compelling. I just hope that our actions in this session match the need that we heard about through that testimony. Thank you.
I believe in our budget priorities that actually the people with disabilities came out number one. If you want to begin while John is still passing out all this information that we requested.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taves from Seniors and People with Disabilities from the Department of Human Services. And first of all, thank you for the week. I hope we've been responsive, and we will continue to try to be as responsive as we possibly can in providing you with all the information you need to make, obviously, very difficult decisions. And I think we all brought money for Rosie today on the last day, even though I don't think...
Oh, thank you.
I don't think any of us used an acronym all week, but we thought we'd make a voluntary contribution anyway.
Rosie has felt neglected this week.
So, with that, Madam Chair, what I'd like to do very briefly is just give a couple responses to some of the public testimony, some of our observations in response to some of the public testimony. We would like to go through the prioritized list. We'd like to show you what we've gathered so far in terms of questions and need for information requested by committee members throughout the week and what we still have pending, what we're still gathering. So we'll go through that pretty quickly. We would like to talk about a couple, at least two or three of the budget notes. I think there were 10 overall. They are in the budget book, but there were a couple that we thought we should highlight for the committee. So that's what we were planning for today and anything else that that you wish. Just a couple comments about the public testimony, which obviously was very poignant, and it's very difficult for many of us to hear because we care deeply about our seniors and people with disabilities, and we have all struggled through the past year and a half in looking at budget reduction scenarios. So the testimony is so poignant, and I'm so amazed that it's so often without any rancor or bitterness. People simply tell their stories with such poignancy. But there's a couple observations. I want to start first with some of the provider rate issues that were raised primarily by the DD, developmental disability providers. We are very concerned about what's happening to our provider community, and we will now probably be heading this next biennium into a third or fourth year without a cost of living adjustment. And as you heard, the cost increases, particularly in insurance, is skyrocketing for the industry. And we are being informed almost every week that more and more people are being dropped entirely from liability insurance. The carriers simply aren't offering.
James, help me with that. On the one hand, I think we require that they carry the insurance, and I don't know what the level is. Is it 500, a million? And yet I have received some correspondence from some of the homes that they are being dropped.
Madam Chair, I think, is it 1 million? I think it's 1 million coverage that the state requires in its contracts, and we're about to have some emergency meetings because we're aware that some programs have already been dropped, so technically they're in violation of our contract, but we obviously want them to stay in business. But I think this portends some disturbing trends that are going to play out in the next year or so. And we've talked to some of the provider representatives that we probably need to put our heads together and start looking at any kind of self-insurance model that we could possibly generate in the industry, because I think the major carriers are going to continue to drop these kinds of programs. So that's
Would you, in your discussion, also look at the possibility of whether or not credit ratings are being used with the industry? You know, we passed out a bill today out of the Senate where insurance carriers are looking at credit ratings as one of the that goes into the black box and as one of the tools, and which is unfair. It doesn't have anything to do with loss ratios. But if you don't have a high, you know, good credit rating, would you include that in your discussion when you're talking
sure.
to the individuals?
Sure. Sure, Madam Chair. So that is an area of concern that we are we completely agree, and we'll be doing some considerable work on that. Some of the other concerns expressed, several people were very concerned that Oregon's home and community-based waiver may be at risk in all of these reductions. And we just wanted to report back again that we have been very, very sensitive to that issue throughout. We've had very many discussions with the federal government, conference calls with officials back in Baltimore, as well as the region in Seattle. And we are appraising them of every reduction that we've either contemplated or actually taken. We have walked them through well in advance what kind of changes we'll be proposing long before it hits their desks. We have asked for feedback or suggestions or ideas from other states. I think Oregon is kind of off the chart in terms of the degree of long-term care cuts, and so there really aren't some other great examples out there right now. But we're keeping in touch with the federal partners on a constant basis. And I think you've already heard in our previous testimony that, I mean, that's why we kind of settled at level 10 and drew a line and felt we couldn't go deeper on the level cuts because we at that point would put the whole waiver in serious jeopardy. And if we lost that, obviously we would lose the federal financing for all community services and have virtually nothing left except a small amount of general funds and a nursing facility program. So that is an area that we're tracking very, very closely, and we want to assure people that we do not intend to put that risk that waiver at risk. The other issue that was raised repeatedly is the concern about a cap on the waiver or limited caseload growth, and we are thinking through very carefully what that means for next biennium, because we have virtually no caseload growth in the budget. That means that no matter where the level cuts end up, in the governor's revised budget, he restores levels 10 and 11 in the co-chairs. Restore level 10. So wherever we end up there after we're done with the level cuts, beyond that we still have virtually no caseload growth for next biennium. And if we in effect don't consider everybody coming in the door within the higher impairment levels that are now still eligible, if we do not consider them as a mandated caseload, then we will begin waiting lists, and we will have to triage which people get services and how long they wait. At the same time, and I think we talked about that in the first day, at the same time that those people are still eligible for nursing facility services. So it's going to become a very difficult balancing act to make sure our nursing facility caseloads don't suddenly ramp up very quickly at nearly 2 to 3 the times what the costs would have been if we had served them in the community. So that's something that we're going to have to track, and we agree that that's an area of concern. I wanted to briefly respond. Ellen Lowe raised the issue yesterday on what's happening in the termination of the general assistance program, since even post-termination there are still SSI recoveries that are in the pipeline that will continue to accrue into next biennium. And the figure she used was about $6.2 million, which would have otherwise come in as other fund to the program. And that is correct. That is other fund that will continue to accrue because of the recoveries, and in the governor's balanced budget, that other fund simply offset other general funds, I think in nursing facilities, I'm not sure which category. So in effect, in the governor's balanced budget, that cut has already been taken. There's not recoveries that are sitting outside the budget that we could utilize to plow back into the general assistance program unless we reauthorized that whole program. But we can certainly supply more information, and we'll give detailed information to Ellen as well about where those recoveries are. Very briefly, you heard quite a bit of testimony from some of the brokerages on the developmental disability side that were created to, in large part, to fund the Staley Agreement, and we simply wanted to echo our agreement that that has been proven for us as a very cost-effective way of providing services, particularly in this case on an entitlement basis because of the lawsuit, where we were able to take a relatively small amount of dollars compared to people that historically have gone into either institutions or into full-blown residential care, keep people with their families and in their communities, and provide some cash and counseling support, and be able to network them with other community resources and try to keep kids and adults and families still together. And I think it's been proven effective. It's run out of a nonprofit sector model, not using government-funded case managers, and I think we're only a year or so into that, but we simply want to echo with that testimony that we think that's been an effective model. Madam Chair, those were some of the main issues raised in the testimony, and unless you would like us to respond to any of the others, we would certainly be happy to do that.
Representative Bates.
Well, Madam Chair, just a couple of questions that you can maybe flush out some more information for me. One was expected caseload increases as our population ages. We know it's going to happen, and we know we've got this big bulge out there in 10 years, but I'd like to have an idea what the ramp-up looks like for the next biennium. And the other question was a little more information about the liability insurance crisis, what it means for community settings and extended care facilities. I had not heard until you just mentioned it that insurance was no longer available for some facilities. But I knew that the rates have gone up tremendously. If you give me more information about that, I would appreciate that.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we will do that. We're just hearing within the last matter of days and weeks that carriers are actually canceling, and some can't get insurance at all. And for many others, the rates are skyrocketing. So I think this has been a worry for some years, and it's just now really beginning to materialize.
James, what's your timeline? When are you having your meetings and looking at this issue? Because I was aware that this issue existed, and on two fronts, both one, the rate increases plus that they were dropping individuals. And so you're going to begin your discussion on this with, I'm assuming, the stakeholders and providers.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Would you, when you have that meeting and when you're at the stage of talking about some resolution, send that information to me?
Madam Chair, absolutely.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
I'd be especially interested to know if some of these facilities have planned to close because of this. I know in some areas of liability like this, they feel the liability is too great, and instead of continuing the programs, they just step aside and don't want to risk their personal incomes and personal values, and so they just step out of the picture, which puts a bigger pressure on the rest of the system. So I'd be interested in that question, as well as how much it drives the overall rates.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I don't, to my knowledge, we've not heard of someone actually planning to close at this time, but we're quite concerned. So we will absolutely provide that information.
You weren't here, Representative Bates, but the other piece of the of that I've asked them to ask the providers is whether or not credit ratings have been used in setting the rates. That's a huge issue, and if there aren't any, if there hasn't been any losses and what have you, what are the drivers? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we privileged as a part of the loan covenants to have access to current financial statements for each of the recipients of these loan funds?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I don't think I understand the question.
Well, we have assisted living facilities that are at risk. They are recipients of loan funds that are state monies. As a part of the loan covenant, which is not unusual, by the way, in loans to provide financial statements. Is that covenant existing in those loan documents? And if it is, not necessarily to have item by item, but at least have an accumulative statement of profit and loss of those recipients of those loan funds. It provides a way of measuring the degree of risk, which is, it ultimately comes back to a financial number. And that's, just understand.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, yeah, I understand. I was still talking about the liability insurance. I didn't track to your question. That's okay.
I was wrapped up on something else.
Oh, so you weren't following the gist of the insurance. You went to another.
I apologize for that.
For the record, I'm Julia Huddleston with the Department's Office of Rate Setting. The Housing and Chair Winter, Senator Morris, the Housing and Community Services Department has access and regularly gets copies of certified financial statements. And those are the documents from which they did the analysis in front of you.
We're back on the ALS default.
Yes, we are, Chair Winter.
I stepped out of the room. I'm sorry. But,
Chair,
if there was some way of knowing the degree of risk, it would help, I think, in making a decision. If you have, you know, many months of cumulative losses, and then this just is the straw that breaks the camel's back if we go to a rate schedule that just virtually wipes out the capacity to stay alive.
I think that your rate schedule and that you were going to provide that talks about, and we can ask that Bob Repine to look at that schedule where it does talk about what the rate currently is, what the future rate would be, and how long would it take for the based on those rates for the ALF to go into default.
Chair Winters, yes, I understand. There's the Housing and Community Services is still working on their piece of that.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My questions are also about the assisted living facilities, and I'm looking at the display of where they're located and total units, et cetera. I really need to understand what will happen to the people involved here, the Medicaid residents. Where will those people go? You've captured for us that these 844 units involving 458 people are in immediate risk of failure. Immediate means when?
Chair Winter, Senator Gordley, to the best of my knowledge, immediate means 30 days after we implement the rate cuts.
And the people will go where?
Chair Winter, Senator Gordley, we got this list from Housing yesterday afternoon. There's staff in DHS who are currently contacting case managers for each facility involved, posing exactly that question. And we plan to have that information to the committee by the end of this week.
All right. Madam Chair, I just want to stress that I would like us to know what will happen to each and every one of the 458 people. Where are they supposed to go? And then secondly, looking at the bottom of the page, total future risk of failure means what? Future meaning when? That's 77 more people who will lose their residence.
Chair Winter, Senator Gordley, as I understand from this letter, within about 3 months plus 30 days of the rate cut being implemented.
Yeah. Again, I would like us to understand what will happen to each of the 77 people. Where will they go?
George, would... and we dealt with this last budget cycle, so the information that was provided last budget cycle in breaking out the rates, and I'm sure that you've read somewhere in this Mr. Britton, we will get those rate structures again as to what it means if we pay X rate, what it means if we pay the next level, and what it means if we pay the next level. This body will have that responsibility to make those determinations and decisions. So it would be helpful if you give us the spread like you did the last budget cycle.
Work on that, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Okay, Madam Chair, we were going to turn to the prioritized list and talk briefly about that.
Yep. Right. I just think we're finished.
Madam Chair, again, by way of explanation, because I know this list looks a little different than a lot of the other lists from the different service areas in the department, in that such a huge amount is clumped in one or two areas and then much smaller amounts that are ranked farther down. And this goes back again to the discussion we had on the first and I think somewhat into the second day about the issue around 100% of SSI. That, again, if we say, based on our belief what CMS would do, we can't cut below level 11 or, level 10, that the only way that we then could take further reductions is to go to an income standard. And because of the income cap trust, that means we have to flatline it at 100% of SSI. So that then becomes a huge dividing point in terms of who you serve and who you don't serve, and that's why we create such huge clumpings in the first couple of areas, the first being all seniors and people with disabilities, including developmental disabilities, that are under the 100% of SSI standard, and then those priority number two would be those over the 100% of SSI standard. And I think we indicated the other day if we eliminated the second level there, for those over 100% of SSI, we're talking about reducing services to another 10,000 individuals, about 8,000 of which would actually be in 24-hour care, either in group homes or in a variety of our community residential facilities. So that's why those clumpings are so large. It was not our intent to rank programs for children below adults, except again for the fact that we had such large clumpings around the 100% of SSI. Children, you saw and heard from some of the individuals the other day, including those kids we have in 24-hour care and medically fragile and intensive in-home support, kids still living at home with their families. We made a deliberate change with state policy, I think, 6 years ago when we moved services for kids out of child welfare and into the developmental disability side of the department. And the purpose was that historically in child welfare, we took only kids out of their home and into 24-hour care when parents were required to give up custody, and the court actually awarded custody of the child to the state. And we changed that policy and really opened it up and encouraged families on a voluntary basis, if they absolutely couldn't maintain their son or daughter at home, that they could go into 24-hour care and we wouldn't force them to lose custody. But in ranking children's programs, that's if we start chipping away at kids' programs, that's probably where we would have to end up, is back in the days when we took only kids where the court actually awarded custody to the state. I don't know if you want me to go into details in some of the other smaller items farther down the list.
Would you talk to us about Oregon Project Independence and the issue that I believe Jacqueline Zimmer-Jones raised with respect to maintenance of effort?
Madam Chair, we're, as part of the next issue, we're going to go through our OPI report. We now have the maintenance or the match requirement for every local area of the state, all the local AAAs. We're still working on the exact formula for the state administration, but we have a chart on that, and we'll walk you through that chart in a few minutes, if that's okay. Would you like any more detail on the other items on the list, or?
I don't hear anything from the committee members?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry, ma'am. One popped up. Representative Bates.
This is your, Madam Chair, I understand this is your prioritization list.
Correct.
Okay. I was wondering why, some of it just is not as clear to me. Should spousal pay, which does a great deal to keep individuals out of ALFs or out of extended care facilities, is rated below nursing home reform and lifespan respite. And it's got significantly matched federal dollars to it.
It's no match.
Other funds, I should say, to it. I don't know if it's match money. What was the policy decision on that? What was driving the policy and making that a lower priority for you?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, it was fairly simple. It's not a good policy decision, but all of those individuals that receive support from their spouses for whom we provide general or other fund support would be eligible for Medicaid. So, in fact, we could pick up the federal match for caretakers to come into their own home. Again, it would be their preference. They would prefer to have that done through their own family member or spouse, but we could still provide and extend services to most of those individuals. So that's why we ranked it lower than some of the others.
So, Madam Chair, so if we hire someone to come into the home, we can get federal match. If we hire the spouse, we can't.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, this has been a long-standing issue. This committee historically has sent us back to the federal government many times. It's a federal requirement. It's a change that has to happen in Medicaid. It just does, because it makes all the sense in the world. But at this point, we have not gotten federal approval for Medicaid.
Thank you for that explanation.
Madam Chair, with one clarification, the other funds that you see in that column are Medicaid upper payment limit loan funds. So in essence, this is a general fund only program, for that clarification.
Madam Chair.
Senator Carter.
Mr. Tate, what I'm interested in, and more or less this as a comment in your answer to what follow-up has been done to find out what has happened to clients who lost services. It would appear to me that that between your CHOP and the Area Agency on Aging People, that we want to kind of have a good idea where people are, especially in these tumultuous times of financing, so that we will have some kind of way that even when the news media calls upon us or average citizen in this state want to know what happened and where are these people, we'd have some kind of contact. And I'm not sure how hard that'd be, how costly it would be, or anything else, but it just seemed to me to be in the interest of those of us who provide services to the elderly and to those that are mentally ill that we'd want to know, have some kind of idea about what they are. Again, if we were to see data to in any kind of effort at all, I know just in terms of Senator Gordley and myself, who is interested in looking at some new revenue, and if we were to come to you and try to find out where these people are, we'd have no idea where they are. And that kind of stuff, I think, would be very helpful to know.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, in the full packet, we've collected some information and are collecting additional information about that, about specific kinds of examples of people that have lost services, those area agencies that are actually tracking individuals that have left service, and we're doing some additional surveying. So we're trying to gather as much of that information as we possibly can. Some is in here, and some more will be forthcoming.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't mean to back up on you, but I'm afraid I'm going to have just for a second because I'm trying to digest this information as quick as we can. We just got to hand it to us. And the letter from Bob Repine about the homes that are at immediate risk of failure, as I read this, it appears to me these are the homes in which we have financial risk as a state. And there should be homes we have no financial risk in, but which may be facing the same type of closures. The number of people we're talking about could be much larger. Do you have any idea how many other homes are at immediate risk of a failure, and how many lives are involved in that, how many of those people are involved? Senator Gordley was very interested in tracking each and every one of the people, these 400 people involved in this, but there might be a far larger number out there we're not involved with that will be in the same position. We just don't happen to be financially involved in their situation. as far as funding their facility. Do you have any idea what that number is and how many others there are?
Madam Chair, Julia, do we have that from OCA? Sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, Julia Huddleston, DHS. We compiled some of that information with the help of the Industry Association during the 2001 session and can certainly begin to compile it again. The department doesn't regularly collect financial information, though, from community-based care facilities because we have no statutory or regulatory mandate to do so. But with the help of the associations, again, we can begin that effort. It varies widely, as I think Jim Carlson mentioned when he was testifying, because some assisted living facilities, a very few, even those that aren't publicly financed, may have 50 to 60% Medicaid clients, and then some may have no Medicaid clients. So it varies by facility, by market, and by region, but we can certainly begin to compile the information again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a constituent that sent me a letter, and it was had to do with their the family's her mother that was in need of care, and they had the means to help, but they couldn't cover all of the expenses, and they were told that they would either have to pay for all of the expenses or none of the expenses. Could you elaborate on that policy? And it seems to me to be counterproductive if a family wants to help and the assistance but can't do it all.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, that is an excellent question, and I'll, if I get in trouble here, I'll have Julia bail me out again. But and I don't want to just routinely blame the feds for things, but under the Medicaid program, historically, families or private individuals have not been allowed to supplement the Medicaid rate because, in theory, with the Medicaid rate, you're buying at least a substantial portion of the service, and other kinds of income or contributions that are coming in have been treated as income to the individual. That is a policy that's being debated, I know, around the country. We have a work group that we've identified that's going to start working on that, whether there's any kind of waivers that we could obtain where a family contribution on top, or if we could design a package of minimal supports and the family then could augment that package with private contributions. And it's certainly something that has a lot of interest, but at this point in time, we haven't figured out a way in the Medicaid world to do that. But I think it's a very logical place to go.
Senator Morris, I have asked and I've been working with Congresswoman Darlene Hooley on that very subject, and I've got her working back in Washington to see if we can't get some assistance, because, you know, I think we all sit here and agree that there should be some way that we could have support from the families without having to do our method of spend down and some of those other issues.
And, Madam Chair, I think, and to follow up with Senator Morris, the Medicaid, again, when you look at the demographics and the long-term issues, really needs to be rethought in some major ways. I mean, the issue that just came up about spouses. I mean, why would we penalize a person and say, you know, we won't provide financial support for your own spouse to provide care for you in the home, but we'll pay Medicaid for someone to come in outside of the home as a caregiver. I mean, those are examples. The private pay is an issue. If we're really able over time to take advantage of long-term care insurance, how long-term care insurance would factor into Medicaid, I think is a major issue that needs to be thought through not only in Oregon but nationally as well. We completely agree. Madam Chair, moving on, just very briefly on this document, the responses to questions and comments from the committee. We've tried to organize them by those of you who asked the question and then by content area. a couple comments, and it's too voluminous to go through it all, but we would absolutely be willing to meet with any of you individually or together to go through this in more detail. There are a variety of items in here that are pending. The biggest area is the large number of questions that you asked about protective services and abuse investigations from the other day. We're taking the time, and we'll need about another week to put together actually a special report back to you. And the reason for that is we have multiple databases. We have one database for non-facility-based abuse, one for facility-based abuse, and then we have separate data sets that are kept at the local level. And what we're doing is pulling all that together, and rather than simply sort of dumping that back on you, we're reorganizing it around the questions and the categories that you wanted the information. So I think if you indulge us with a little extra time, I think we can put together a very good report that will actually provide very meaningful data on how we track abuse, how many cases are open, how many are substantiated, and what the categories are and how those fall out. That's the biggest block of issues in here where we have not pulled data together at this time. Just the other thing to mention is some of these are pulled off of different kinds of reports, and so the format may look different from different parts to the other, but again, if we have not been responsive to the area of your concern or question, if you would let us know, because we will certainly take the time and effort to put that together.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. It would be my request that you have completed that report around the abuse reporting issue, that report, and Madam Chair, I don't know how we would do this given where we may be at that point in time, but I would hope that that information would be shared in a very public manner. This is a huge issue of public concern, aside from our own legislative concern, and I'm least interested in one-on-one meetings with the department, although I will do that, and much more interested in public disclosure of how are we handling this area, and what changes are we making where we find it's necessary to do that.
President, James, how much time are you talking about before the report will be completed, number one? What's your timeline on the completion of the report?
Madam Chair, I think we're thinking a week.
A week to 2 weeks, which probably would put us into work session by the time the report comes to us. In fact, we would be in work session on it. I am very interested in it, particularly a couple of reasons. I think that it's when you hear of abuse, whether we're talking about children or whether we're talking about seniors, it just hits at the core of one's being as a society, and that bothers me and troubles me greatly. Also, another piece of it, and I thought maybe the report would be here when the long-term care ombudsman comes in, because I know that they also are dealing with this issue, and I want to try to put the two pieces together if I could. As you know, I'm very troubled. And it's no secret, I've been troubled that when I came back into this building, that on the one hand we have the, quote, the advocacy, but I hadn't heard anything. And then when you look at these reports and you're seeing that this is what's happening out there in the world, my first question was, why hasn't this been out in the public domain? You know, and these statistics are staggering when you begin to think about it. And so I'm very concerned. So when you get the report, if this body needs to make it public, we will. It was just troubling. It was troubling to hear those statistics. And I would like to know, you know, where they're coming from, what part of the industry it's coming from, who's doing it. It's just the same problem I have when I deal with the children's issue, when we're talking about abuse and neglect, and when we're talking about protecting our most vulnerable in our society, whether it needs to be that we need to do a better job of educating society or whether we need to close down more facilities. I just think we need to know. So I'm with you, Senator Gordley, on this particular issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Then, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn to some of the remaining budget note issues that are pending. And in the original budget book, starting on page 6-2, is just a brief narration of the 10 different budget notes that we worked on during the last biennium. And there's several of them that I think we should highlight for you that have generated either questions or concern over time, and we'd like to take a brief opportunity to do that. The first one I'd like to talk about is the Veterans Project. This was a budget note from last biennium requesting that we fund pilot projects in two counties, where in effect we would pay for veteran staff, veterans officers, who would do extensive outreach to people who potentially eligible for veterans benefits. And part of the assumption was that if we could target individuals who otherwise would be eligible for Medicaid, that would create potentially some major savings in the Medicaid budget and in the general fund that accompanies the Medicaid budget. So that was the premise or the hypothesis for the project. We went forward with the project in the two counties. We provided two separate reports to the emergency board. The last one was in November. And we confirmed that there are savings, although we and the pilot areas never agreed exactly on what the savings were for a couple of reasons. And the reason I want to highlight that is there's also a proposed bill, House Bill 3609, that would have the department fund three more pilots in three parts of the state, again based on the same theory. If we hire VA staff to do outreach to get people eligible for veterans, then we'll have savings in the Medicaid budget. The dilemma for the department and the reason that it was difficult to reach agreement on exactly what the savings were is that the Medicaid budget of the department is not allocated to each county or AAA or local office. It's a statewide Medicaid budget. And the caseload of the statewide Medicaid budget goes up or down for a whole variety of reasons. And it was difficult for us to figure out exactly what individuals who otherwise would have been eligible for veterans would have obviously gone on Medicaid, and exactly how you then track that savings in a huge caseload statewide and then track it back to the individual county or program. And what we ended up saying is that obviously if there are Medicaid caseload savings statewide through a rebalance plan, we can bring back to the legislature or to the emergency board and say here are the savings that would be available that we could transfer back and pay for either existing veteran staff or even add staff if that proves to be a good methodology. I think what we have found throughout the biennium is typically because of many other reasons we didn't have Medicaid caseload savings, and in fact we usually had deficits that we had to address in the rebalance plan, and the issue then became whether we had to go back and reimburse these areas based on a rebalance plan that we would bring to the emergency board. What we're working with AAAs and our local offices now is to try to come up with a different methodology. We've discussed, first of all, whether we could actually allocate a Medicaid budget to each local area. And even though it's an entitled or a mandated caseload statewide, that we could, between our sort of complicated payment and information systems, actually do a local allocation. And if we could do a local allocation, then obviously for every individual that you can divert or get onto the veterans program, you've locally saved Medicaid dollars. And if the department agreed that we wouldn't proportionately reduce the Medicaid dollars, that would allow folks at the local level to enrich the program. And given where we're going this next biennium with such tight caseload growth, that would have a lot of advantages. But we're just in very early negotiations with the AAAs and others on what a local allocation might look like. It's a lot of complicating factors because we've never done that before and we don't have the information and payment systems that have ever been set up to do that. So that is a set of discussions and negotiations that are underway. And then we could actually do an apple-for-apple scenario in terms of a veteran's dollar that offsets a Medicaid dollar. But until such time, we simply don't know how to go forward in an apple-for-apple scenario where we could take Medicaid caseload savings and divert it into veteran officer programs. And the other issue for us as well is that with very limited caseload growth, even people potentially eligible for Medicaid in this next biennium may be on waiting lists. So there may not even, for some people eligible for veterans benefits who might otherwise be eligible for the Medicaid dollar, the dollar may not even be there to offset. So I'm just relating this back because this has gotten a lot of attention. It is, again, a bill that may be coming to you, and we just don't know how to reach an exact formula on how to fund that. So I'll be happy to answer any questions on that. That's where we're at. Madam Chair, the other issue we wanted to raise, and Mr. Britton distributed a letter today that recently came from the Secretary of State, is how we're approaching program monitoring or case reviews or viewing the reassessments that are occurring, in large part that were driven by the cuts, but more importantly, how we track accuracy and program integrity over time. And I talked at some length on the first, I think, and second day about that issue. We have had between the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, I think in the 99 session, budget notes from this committee, Secretary of State, we have a commitment to the Centers on Medicaid and Medicare when they did their last audit that the department would routinely go out and do case reviews, at least 1% or more of random case reviews in the field, again, to assure program integrity and caseload accuracy. And as I described the other day, particularly now with the hundreds, indeed thousands of reassessments that are occurring because of the level cuts, the volume here is so much higher than it's ever been, and questions have been raised whether the assessments are being done accurately, because again, this whole system was never designed to triage thousands of people out of service, so to speak. So that is something that we take very, very seriously, and we have staff now routinely in the field that are doing reviews of the reassessments. And by the time CMS comes back for a follow-up audit, we have to assure them that we have a regular process for doing field reviews. And we created a field review team last biennium. We carved out of existing positions to do that, and we've had vacancies and other delays in that. But we have created that process. We did joint work with the AAAs and local state offices. It's not just the AAAs. It's also local state offices that run part of this caseload on what the protocols are, how we approach those reviews, and we're going to refine that again. But I just want the committee to know that we take this charge very, very seriously, and with our partners, we intend to very aggressively continue to review the assessments, assure accuracy, and continue out into the future, a routine process for doing case reviews.
No, I don't. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wessler.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing this to our attention and pointing out the Secretary of State's letter. I think this is an important part of the accountability piece that we're all very concerned about, and I particularly appreciate the fact that in place, and I serve on the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, looking at some of the oversight to eligibilities in many different categories, certainly just not Medicaid levels, you know, 10 through 14, 15 through 17. And I know you alluded to this in your remarks, but I just want to make sure the committee is very aware that when the Medicaid levels were established as functionally a methodology for putting people on the list, not taking people off. And that's what we functionally asked the AAAs to do, stop going down, you know, one path and immediately switch gears and get on another horse and ride in a different direction. So I just want the committee to be aware of that as they read the Secretary of State's letter. And, Madam Chair, if it would please you, I can give a response from the AAAs, which they agree with several of the assessments of the Secretary of State's office, and point out, I think, some further additions that could improve the process. If you'd like me to distribute this or have Mr. Britton distribute this, I'd be very happy.
I think we would have Mr. Britton distribute or either have the AAA.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
I'm going to speak as a physician just for a moment, if I could, and put my other hat on.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative.
When you look at the disability levels, they are verbal descriptions of how people live and what their disabilities are. There's a lot of room for movement in that. As a physician looking at those, I couldn't tell you if someone's at a 10 or 11 or a 12. I could tell you if they're a 17 or an 8. This is a very gray area, a very difficult area to work in, and people are constantly changing. Some of those areas of disability will change from day to day for those clients, or in a year's time, that same patient would have changed their level of disability also, usually obviously in a negative fashion. I think we have to be very careful here in doing an audit in such a narrow area when you're talking about moving from a level of a 10 to a 9, and that means whether you get services or not. And I think looking at the audit from that point of view may put a little different cast on it. These are not easy decisions for case managers to make. The target they're looking at is changing all the time. And even someone, I think, who's a physician who's supposedly trained looking and dealing with these people all the time is going to have a difficult time placing people in the proper categories. This is a really difficult thing to quantitate. I think we have to be very, very careful in making decisions about whether the case manager is doing the job they're supposed to be doing or not. And I do take a little exception with the author's report. I'm just wondering if you can really hone down like that and make a decision that case managers are gaming the system in any way. I think they probably are not. And that when you are focused down on one line, they start looking at people much more carefully at that level, trying to make a decision compared to dropping them into 17 lines.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, you're absolutely right. And actually, we had long discussions with the auditors about this. And I think on the first day, I talked at some length about our difficulty in switching gears and using this assessment process now to cut people out of services as opposed to a broad eligibility tool and more of a service planning tool. It has been a huge and we've done this in a matter of months. So we had to, in a short matter of months, refine the rule, do mass training, netcasts, weekly calls with all our managers in the field. We had to create very quickly to take an existing methodology and use it for something it was never intended to do. So I think we are almost hypersensitive about that. I think one of the people said it best the other day in testimony that case managers from our system, when there was a knock at the door, it was always to be there to help or to offer assistance, and now it's almost the fear that the case manager is coming out. And you can sort of hear the language out there among many of our clients fearing, am I going to be next? Is someone going to come and tell me I've now been kicked out of service? So it's just a massive cultural shift to begin with. So I think we're hypersensitive to that. What we feel we need to do is to keep refining this process, number one, to make it more accurate. And I think mostly we're concerned about the big outliers because, again, there is room for judgment, and we've taken a lot of steps to make it much more objective, but there is still room for judgment. And I think what the auditors were trying to point out is that we have a major change since we started implementing the level cuts. Well, I think we would expect that, too, simply because of the sheer volume of reassessments that occurred and the fact that historically no one ever looked at discreetly because if you were level 17 or below, you were in. So I think we completely agree, and we are not out to witch hunt our local partners or case managers or anybody else. And we have met continuously with them, and I think we're trying to develop a joint agenda to say, you know, we have this burden now. We are reducing services to people. We are using the level cuts. And we have budget targets associated with that, and it's very difficult for us to do. And we're not trying at the edges or the margins to cut people out, but to look at at really where the outliers are, and I think that's where we'll focus most of our attention.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Weston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I very much appreciate you saying that because, you know, one of the recommendations that the Secretary of State's letter makes and one of the few areas, or I should say the area that I think the letter from the AAA's most disagrees with, and yet we've still got to do this. I mean, we've got to develop a methodology, you know, to determine, you know, spot checks and accountability and an oversight function. No question. No one's arguing that. AAA's aren't arguing that. I'm not arguing that. But I think one of the areas that where they most disagree with the Secretary of State's analysis is if you show up on Monday, that can be a good day or a bad day. And if you show up 2 days later, you could have a completely different, you know, evaluation. And in cases where we're dealing with life-changing and, in some cases, life-threatening changes to people's lives, we've all got to work together to come up with the proper, you know, accountability methodology. I think that's part of your responsibility. I think that's definitely part of this committee's responsibility. Anyway, thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I have to weigh in because this panel, and I think certainly we want to move in a very cooperative way, but also this legislative body has required that we increase and intensify accountability. And I see things like this as a tool. I mean, certainly there's some disagreements inside of some of it, but if you look at it from a way of trying to improve services, try to improve a system, you know, certainly, you know, the Secretary of State's coming from one level, which may not have all the information either, but still, I think if you look at recommendations from the standpoint of improving, I think we can go a long way. I don't look at it as an indictment against anyone, but simply that we must tighten up the system. This body has been, as your chair of last session, I have been particularly emphasizing the need for greater accountability. Under your leadership, Mr. Co-chair, when you were there, and I'm not going to vacate or move away from that position. And if we can make systems better to where the data and the information that we collectively ask for with the relationship between the AAAs and the state agencies and this body, I think it actually makes all of our jobs easier. It also does something else. It also provides the accountability that we need in order to validate, if you will, and justify the budgets that we send out of here. You know, and we say to the community, when we're doing that, to those who are paying the tax bill, we know exactly what's going on, and we have asked for accountability. We have received that accountability. Senator Yee isn't here, but I remember Senator Yee's counsel, and it has stuck with me through the previous session and through this. We must, and I think the governor has said it, we must change the way that the general public perceives what we're doing in these buildings. Rightly or wrongly, they have a perception that somehow or some way that the job isn't getting done in state government. And a part of that is when you ask a question, when you're out and I'm out and somebody asks you something and you can't respond. And so the collection of data and that information, I think, becomes critical. The assessments to make certain that we're constantly on our job, doing our job in a very good way, and at the same time making certain that people who need the services are getting the services that we say we're going to provide. And we're in it together. I don't see a separation between the state agencies, the AAAs, or this body sitting here. You know, if there's a separation, I think this climate and this budget crisis tells us that this boat, that we're all there. Yesterday, at the hearings that we had, and the citizens and the faces that come before us that have the need for the services that we provide, I wish that all 90 members in this building would have been here yesterday. You know, I wish that the testimony that's provided by the individuals that we see, that the rest of this body does not see. I said, maybe that might make our job a little easier. But, you know, we see and hear things that the rest of these members do not. And anyway, I just had to say that. But it's not an indictment. I see it as a way to improve on what we're doing. And certainly I hope nobody intends it that somebody's out to get somebody or anything like that. But it's where we're all in this together to make the best that we can and to provide the best services that we can in the state of Oregon. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may, I'd like to take the discussion just in a little bit different direction. We've been focusing for quite a number of days on programs and reductions in programs, and I'd like us to step back and look at the delivery system that creates the possibility of delivering those programs. We're looking at about $282 million in program support and central administration services, and that's the number it isn't the revised number yet, but that was the governor's balanced budget proposal. Of that number, $58 million is in central administration. And I did a calculation, which is kind of interesting. If you're looking at what it costs to deliver these services and apply that to a per-client number, we're looking at almost $6,100 per client to provide those services. And I guess my question is, and it should not, I think, be excluded from the discussion in terms of this $282 million number, which incidentally is about a $25 million increase over the 2001-03 budget forecasted 2003-05. What are the opportunities for improvement within program support and central administration that would provide us greater resources to meet the needs of the folks that we had here yesterday?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, if you, I'm trying to think which page that is.
Excuse me, but that's a big question, and it's not one to answer in 30 seconds. Yes.
And that's a question that we will grapple with.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, just a couple quick comments about that, and I know you'll look at that in much more detail, but the 58, to separate the program support to go first to the central administration, the $58 million of that amount, almost $34 million are the government prorates. They're not actually internal to the budget, but they're part of the prorates. And what's then left of the sort of the central administration is about $24 million. And again, that's excluding the program support. And roughly what that supports is 146-147 positions and the SNS and a variety of other contracts, legal services, and all of those things. But that's kind of the core central administration for seniors and people with disabilities. And even there, I think, and I'm not disagreeing or picking an argument, but even of that amount, after all of the reorganization and the way our organization charts have been put together, we probably have another third of that are actually case-carrying positions in the central office. We have children's case managers, we have crisis workers, and nurses and people that really, if they don't carry cases, do almost direct client work. So we really ought to sort of put that in program support or put that in perspective. The program support includes the field staff and all the contract AAAs. We have AAAs where the counties actually have chosen to use all their the case management dollars, and eligibility workers and all of that are done through state workers in local offices that are managed by AAAs, and so that shows up in the support column. We have all the federal licensing and certification requirements. So a lot of that is a regulatory group as well. But I think we'd be happy to take the time to walk through that in much more detail if you would like.
Senator Morris.
Yeah. I think Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we need to look at those opportunities where we can get improvements, and I would be very interested in doing that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm the old codger that's been looking at these budgets for a number of years, and I apologize to you, Madam Chair. I had to go to the Senate President's office for a beating before I came down here, so I may have missed some of what occurred. But as I look at this over the years, the first question that comes to my mind, you got the letter from the Secretary of State, and then Representative Westland shared with us, and I tried to skim real quickly the Area Agencies on Aging's response to that. Because I've always understood it, you contract with AAAs to do some of the work, you know, that's out there for seniors. The state does the direct hands-on work places where you haven't contracted. Isn't that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, sort of, because in some cases the state actually employs the workers that do the work, but they're supervised by the AAA, so we have a few variations there.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Are they all supervised by the AAAs then?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, no. We have about, in the senior and disability side, on the DD side, everything goes through local county government. The state doesn't run any offices directly. On the senior and disability side, about 13 or 14% of our work is done directly by local state offices, field offices of the Department of Human Services.
Okay. Follow-up.
Follow-up. My point here is that in years gone by, the state wanted to make a deal with the counties to get the AAAs to do this work. They contracted with them. They wanted them to do it. They wanted to take advantage of the local resources that local county government could bring to the equation. There's lots of volunteer effort that goes into this. And then the audit comes, and it's an audit of the AAAs. I'm wondering, is there any way to tell just generally whether they're doing any worse a job than the ones that are direct state employees? I mean, you know what I'm saying? I'm just trying to the thing that I'm noticing is that year after year after year, I don't know how many times I've been in this committee when we've been analyzing the AAAs. And I'm wondering if the state itself gets the same kind of scrutiny, and maybe Senator Morris was beginning to hit on that area as well.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, that was not an audit of the AAAs. That was an audit of our field program. So it also included state offices.
Was there a differential between the AAAs and the others?
Madam Chair, and I don't want to speak for the auditors, but I mean the auditors are concerned about their perception of a major swing in reassessments. And what they were doing was not an audit, but a risk assessment. And so what they've advised us is, since the time that the program reductions started and we did hundreds and thousands of reassessments, there's been a much larger number that have moved dramatically into different categories as a result of those assessments. And so they're posing that to us as a risk, saying, you ought to be concerned about that. You ought to go out and be looking and to make sure that people weren't simply reassessed and the numbers were jimmied to keep people eligible. So it's really not an audit. It's much more of a risk assessment. But if I could drive this a little bit deeper even into this issue, based on your comments, Chair Winters, and some of the others, the issue for us here, again, is not to go out and find people doing things wrongly or to criticize our case managers. What we are now doing in the program reductions by using the level cuts, we're balancing a budget or we're reducing a budget based on a system historically not designed to do this work. The other choice we had, again, was to go to an income standard. Highly objective. I mean, nobody can argue about it. It is what it is. And if we had chosen the income standard, because of the income cap trust, we had to go to 100% of SSI. And we toyed for that, actually, for a while. And that was so draconian, and that drove thousands and thousands of people out of service. And it would have left us in the position of a woman with severe Alzheimer's making $600 a month in income, can't even buy her way into long-term care in Oregon. So we discarded that. We said we can't do that. And so we went with the assessment, with all its flaws and history of not being used for this purpose. And the reason why we feel so concerned now to keep fine-tuning that and making sure that even though it's partly subjective, that it's as objective as can be, is people have contested right hearing cases. And so we have to go in front of hearing judges and in contested cases where a person is debating whether or not they were found ineligible for the right reasons. We have a major lawsuit now facing the department. And the lawyers are saying this whole system is totally subjective. Depending on what county you're in, you can get assessed at one level and another level in another place. And our concern and the reason why we're having such frank discussions with our local partners is if we don't make this work, and if the lawyers or anybody else ends up getting this thrown out and we're driven back to the income standard, it is so draconian. It takes us into such a worse place. And so we're afraid of the unintended consequences that could roll out from this. And so, again, we're doing very difficult work when case managers are showing up and assessing people who potentially may be losing services. And nobody is denying it. It's hard on us. It is hard on our local partners. And we're intending to work together. This is not the state going out and doing gotcha to case managers doing this difficult work. But we are balancing a budget and a program around this methodology, and that's why we feel we have to do our best possible work to be accurate, to be accountable, and still very sensitive to the needs of the people that we serve that are very vulnerable, very scared, and our case managers, are the last thing they want to do is drop people out of service. That's their instinct. That's their training, and we recognize that.
Madam Chair,
Senator Shields.
Number one, I want to apologize for being late. And number two, I'm sorry that my question really was kind of a display of my own ignorance. I got here late, but I appreciate very much James's answer because it helped me understand and catch up a little bit with what you've been doing.
Thank you. You know, it might also be helpful for members if, too, there is a organizational chart someplace that shows, where the DD population and that flow to the counties and who has responsibility for what. We do have new members on this committee and as well as the seniors, how many of them are that are state staff that are supervised by AAAs. Where the counties that are not participants at all, because not all counties participate in the AAA program. And that might be very helpful for members of this panel to have a better understanding of the various relationships that exist through the AAA.
Madam Chair, we actually have some maps of the state that back when we could color print that actually would do that. But I think we can shade it in a way that you can see exactly what the variations are and roughly the numbers of staff, and we'll provide that to you right away.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
I can't imagine, and Mr. Taves, you can help us with this, how the case managers are faring right now in terms of their morale, their mental health. These are folks who have got to be exceptionally stressed out. Can you paint a picture for us of what are the conditions that people are working in now? Because that's another side of the picture that we don't hear as much about.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, it's in many of our local offices, both in state offices and in AAAs, it's been absolute chaos, and it's been chaos for months, because as the waves of cuts and letters and notices went out, often to frail people, vulnerable people, they've been very scared, and the first thing they want to know is information, and they're calling or going to the office. And in fairly short time frames, then our case managers, others have to do these thousands of reassessments. So the stress level is obviously incredibly high. And I think collectively in the senior and disability world, there's been sort of a huge depression, quite frankly, that's set in on the entire field. And we're all struggling with that and trying to reposition what this system is now going to look like in the short term in the next couple of years, and how do we, and I think I mentioned again on the first day, how do you at least maintain the framework of the system so that you have the core there, you have the core values that you can rebuild on. And I think in all of our discussions with the field and the local managers, we try to just share that anger and angst and say it's there. I mean, it's the elephant in the room. We shouldn't ignore it. We need to help our staff. We have to help work through this. And in our own meetings in the department, you know, I have constantly shared with our own staff, at the same time that you're grieving for the people that you're discharging from service, you have to figure out how to do it better, how to preserve the basic values. And so, it is a very painful process. We have terminated thousands of people from service. None of us have ever done that before. So this is uncharted territory for all of us.
We didn't do it in the 80s. I just made a comment to Senator Carter. I don't recall that we did this, and I know that there's some individuals in the audience who was here in the 80s.
We didn't.
I'm trying to, and Ruth is shaking her head, I'm just trying to remember in my years of being here when we've ever had this kind of a situation where you're talking about the level of cutting individuals out of service. We're in double-digit inflation now.
Manager, I've been on the Human Services Committee since 1985, and I've never experienced anything like this. Never.
And Madam Chair, I think part of in our discussions with other states, in part what Oregon did is we moved from institutional models to community models and at a much faster pace than the rest of the country. So even in the 80s and some of those difficult years, we were able to leverage more because we converted to a community system and didn't maintain a real expensive institutional system, both on the DD and the senior and physical disability side. And I think other states that are faced with these cuts now are able to utilize some of the opportunities that we took 10, 15, 20 years ago. And that, to some extent, cushions the blow for them. But we moved to a community system very heavily, and that's now where the money is, so that's where we're cutting. So we've lost some of those earlier, kind of easier savings, if you want to call it that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, would you like to move to the OPI report?
Yes,
I was up and down and reading this big.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Lee Fay, Seniors and People with Disabilities.
Would you clarify where we can find the
You're going to find it starting on page
69?
61 of the report.
I was close.
61.
But even before we get into OPI on page 59, I thought I would direct us back to a question that you asked, Madam Chair, regarding local match on Older Americans Act, recognizing that there's a connection at some point with Oregon Project Independence. And one of the questions that was asked earlier in the week was the connection between the federal dollars that are given to us for Older Americans Act and the requirement for a participation of match. And unlike our Medicaid programs where you have a dollar for dollar or a 40 cents to a 60 cents type of match, Older Americans Act is more, here's the amount of money, but each area of each participant has to show a local match unrelated to federal funds. And on page 60, that chart will walk you through what each area agency on aging has, how they have to utilize their Older Americans Act money. And the last column on that chart is the estimated match requirement. Now, these areas can demonstrate that match in either cash or in most cases, an in-kind. The federal government is accepting of in-kind types of matches where they demonstrate a similar type of program being done. And many of our area agencies on aging do that, and they use anything from their senior meal sites to volunteer drivers to a number of areas where they demonstrate their commitment to Older Americans Act funding.
So Meals on Wheels and let's say if you had contributions from the Oregon Food Bank, all that can be counted in as part of
that? Madam Chair, that's correct. And that's where I think the leveraging that the area agencies on aging do with their local partners that really bring many resources, not just state and federal dollars directed to the program, come into play. And so it's an important part of the factor. We have not yet been able to get to you for today. The state also must show a contribution, a similar contribution, where it's not using dollars that are also then matched with federal dollars. As we talked about in our presentation earlier in the week, we've used Oregon Project Independence, and we'll have for you in the next couple of days kind of our formula on how what our match and in-kind contribution has been using Oregon Project Independence. Moving on to page 61, what we have done here is there is a report on Oregon Project Independence that was directed as a budget note from the last legislative session. And as Madam Chair has mentioned throughout this this afternoon's presentation, much of this was directing both the state and our partners to have a better sense of accountability for how dollars are spent, both the dollars that are sent from the state as well as the contribution of fees that are collected for clients. So the report went and did that, but we also, in this report, went back to a series of questions that you all have asked throughout our presentation on Oregon Project Independence. What I thought I would do is have you turn to page 69 of this report, because it starts getting into the questions specifically that you're asking about data and some of the accountability. And the first one was around client fees. This is a project that, along with the state public dollars, this is targeted for individuals who have similar needs to those individuals in long-term care but are above the financial eligibility for Medicaid. And so some of these individuals will actually be able to contribute to the cost of their care, and there's a sliding scale fee that's calculated. One of the things that we had been directed to do last year was to assist the area agencies on aging in making sure that those formulas are evenly applied across the state, and the chart behind it is actually the scale that's used. For example, these type of services are a lot typically related to in-home client-employed providers. And so if somebody is in has an income between $999 and $1,023, they're paying $3.05 towards $8.33 an hour. So they contribute to their services and cares. The areas also have individual contract agencies. They are not state rates. What this formula does is allow them to put in their contract agency rate. And through this process in the last biennium, we have had a more accountable process of identifying how client fees are collected, that everyone around the state is using the same calculation methodology. We require a monthly tracking, on page 71 and 72, it talks about the tracking that we actually are engaged in now. We have strengthened our relationships in terms of getting information about client fees that are contributed, client fees that are expended, as well as expenses in many of the other areas. The other questions that this committee asked was around information about clients themselves. And if you go to page 74, we talked about the difference between the 99-01 biennium and this current biennium. There was approximately 6,000 people served almost 7,000 people served in 9901, and we're close to 4,500 this biennium, and this biennium represents a biennium where there has been reductions in this program. Now, many of these people, only seven of these areas have actually done terminations of clients, and that's only happened in the last couple months. A lot of the difference here has been this is a program that has a lot of revolving door to it, and so a lot of the number differences are in attrition, but what it really means is that this biennium, there were less people that had actually had access to start with. So questions that had been asked about what happens to people who had been terminated from this program, that is a small group. We do have some information from those counties earlier in the packet talking about where people are. Many of those folks had been, there are a small number of people, and they may have been redirected to other community programs. But for the majority of the difference between this biennium and last are the numbers of people who never even got in the door. And in the door means case management here as well. So it's not like they could come in and get case management and get redirected elsewhere, but the limits on that program really limited even the access to case management.
I just noted, and of course, Representative Wesson isn't here. Deschutes County gained. And so did Farney.
Both, some of the things that when we've talked to some of the counties, what might have happened in a couple of the areas is that what they have done is limited what types of services. Again, this particular program is different from Medicaid in that each area takes their allocation and helps prioritize and says, who in our community are we going to prioritize for services, and out of the services we offer, how will we weight them? And in some areas, they may pick one or two or three items that are of high priority, home-delivered meals, respite. And in another, they spread it across to a number. Everyone has access to 10 hours a month of some sort of service or some access to nutrition or meals. And so in the areas such as Deschutes, what they were able to do is they eliminated some programs totally, but they still had the client in their service. So in a few areas, it's how they prioritized and looked at services. And in many others, I think if you go to Douglas County, there's a very large reduction. And what you see there, it's one of the areas where they actually did terminate clients. And they went to saying nobody who is above a service level 3, and if you recall from previous testimony, that's some people with some very significant impairment. They were only able to support individuals who met that criteria. So each area has a different way of approaching it.
As a policymaker, if I was looking at trends and trying to determine, what role or function the state should be playing, it would be helpful to know if meals is high in various counties, if we're looking at those issues, if we're looking at the need for having more people to come in to help with bathing, if it's and that kind of information I think is very helpful from a planning perspective, not only when we're looking at providers and resources, what do we need, in the communities to make sure it's certain that we have adequate workers to go in and assist. I just think that's kind of baseline data that you need to help drive policy decisions.
Madam Chair, we have information that tells us about different categories, but I will say with one of the program benefits to Oregon Project Independence is the first thing they can do is look at their own local community and say, as a community, where are our strengths? And if you're a community where some of your strengths is that there really is a very solid meal program happening from another community place, you wouldn't then go ahead and prioritize that. You would prioritize something else that might be respite. So it's not necessary. It's a challenge to try and say, is there one category that has a different priority over another? Because one of the things we're able to do here is you start first with your community and first with what does your community have to offer, and then you prioritize and say, how will we target these limited resources? So it makes it a challenge to try and say, what are the trends of is there respite or meals that are a greater use in this program.
I guess just basically when you collect your information mm-hmm. from the AAAs or whoever's providing the service, is that part of the data that you collect? What services are being provided?
Madam Chair, we do collect that data.
That's, and as you look at, mm-hmm. at services, you can begin to get a feel, you know, what's needed or what's the driver in the community. That's what I'm saying. I recognize that every community is unique, but I think also that what even though there is a uniqueness to communities, and maybe one community's priority is different, there also tends to become in something, I think, common threads mm-hmm. that weave themselves around services and programs when you're talking about, whether we're talking about the elderly, or whether seniors or children or people with disabilities. You know, immediately when you thought of Meals on Wheels mm-hmm. or meals, my first thought went to the food bank. It went to the services that come out of Meals on Wheels and whether or not, you know, within those communities you have the adequacy. My mind mm-hmm. just goes a little.
Madam Chair.
Guess I never get away from program development.
Madam Chair, I think I share your concerns, a bit of frustration. It's hard for me to look at this and get a real picture of what's going on. You mentioned that you didn't think a lot of clients have actually dropped, but the numbers dropped, and we can't tell what services have changed. And I don't know where those people went or what happened to them. Did they move out of OPI and end up in ELFs and extended care facilities? Did they manage to make it their own with family help or other help? I just can't grasp what's happening here from these numbers, and maybe you mm-hmm. can't either.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I think there are two things to point out on the numbers. Some of the difference in numbers is that there was just no access in, so it was a matter of attrition in many of these communities, so that if you went from 134 people to 78 people the following biennium, that represented just that many fewer people who had access. And secondly, as far as our ability to track, you're absolutely correct. We don't. When someone leaves the service, they also leave case management. And so our ability to say where and how do they come back in, are they now Medicaid eligible? We have information. This biennium, we have started using the same data information between Oregon Project Independence and our long-term care program, whereas last biennium we didn't. So in the future, we will be able to match names to samples and say, can you tell us if Mr. Smith with this case file, it shows up elsewhere in our system, but we don't have that capacity from previous biennium.
Can I ask just a follow-up? Yeah. Just a fundamental. If I look at Wheeler County, for example, there were three client counts, and then this time there's one. How much did of OPI did Wheeler County receive, and what was the service?
Madam Chair, we can go back and put the that kind of anecdotal, both the what is the budget and how did they break that down.
You know, the same as with Sherman. I mean, we're talking about some small Sherman 7 with 3. This biennium, it should be very Gilliam's 9 and 2. I think it gives.
And Madam Chair, they're part of a larger area agency on aging. So these are some of these are counties that are part of that. But we can get that information.
I understand Multnomah County, the granddaddy of them all, would be difficult to do. Senator Gorley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to understand what you just said about attrition, and did you say you didn't have access to that information?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, if by attrition what I mean is that someone may have left not because they were terminated, the program was over, they move on for, they may have indeed moved into a long-term care, or they may have ended up in a different circumstances not needing this. What the difference in number is that they were not able to be replaced, that nobody else knew was able to come into the service. Mm-hmm. So that the numbers between, if there's a difference between 20 and 30 people, it may not be that 20 or 30 people got cut from service, but that when they left the service, the area agency on aging had no capacity to add more people back into the service.
Can I ask a question, and I'll go to Senator Shields and back to Representative Bates.
Madam Chair,
I have, you have follow-up.
Can I follow up? Sure. I'm trying to contrast what you're telling me with the other chart that's on page 48,
okay,
where the attrition information is displayed, and are we not talking about the same?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yeah, what we're saying is in that area, again, it's attrition. Attrition meaning that that's what accounts for the difference in numbers, meaning that they had a number of people leave through whatever circumstances. This is not a long-term care group. There are often people who come and go in and out of this program. And so that normal attrition counted for a number of them. 15, so if you went to Clackamas, 15 people were terminated, although there's almost a 200-person difference between 9901 and 0103.
Okay, I'm missing something, but I'm going to move on, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And yeah, it's very hard.
Well, 99 and 2001, can you tell me what was the total general fund allocation? And then how much in the fees were collected that went back into OPI in 99 and 2001, and the same with 2001 and 2003?
I can tell you in this report on 2000, if you go to page 64, it will tell you the fees collected for 2001-2003. I'll have to go back and look at the 9901. And this was by the biennial amount for 2001-2003 was $13 plus million. That was then reduced to $10 million. So the amount of fees collected was $438,000. Again, the other information in this report will say less than 50% of the
that's
people actually.
Year. Just so that it, that's a 1 year figure, right?
Yeah.
For
01, 02. Oh, I'm sorry. For plus the 174. I thought that was both together. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. You're correct. It's 438 during the first year of this biennium, 174,000 for to date yet in this second year of the biennium.
Senator Shields.
I'm intrigued by this, the term you use. And if I could go to our chairperson's favorite county, Marion County, on, you know, the chart that we've been looking at. You talk about there were, in 99, 2001, 396 people, 2001, 03, 240. You talk about the difference in that number not being because people were terminated, but because circumstances changed and so on, and because of limits on capacity, because of budget issues, they never got through the door. Okay, the term never got through the door. That doesn't mean that the human misery index didn't go up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just that we don't know about it.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, yes, thank you for saying it so eloquently. I think what we are trying to say is that we don't know about people because they may not have been terminated. They may never have had access to the service to start with. And access to the service even included case management, which would never have been able to say, how do I get you access or resources or information? So the numbers here, although we can't tell you the story about what happened to them, we can say we know a number of people never even got through the door.
That you said it very eloquently, and even though you picked Marion County.
Well, I just wanted to, this is where I'm sitting right now, and I mean, the statistics don't tell anything about the human misery index because they can't get onto the list. They can't get inside the door.
Yeah. I'm going to, and thank you, remind the members that tomorrow, there will not be a hearing tomorrow, Mr. Britton is going to pass out a memorandum to you from me. And please take it very, very, read it. Next week we will start completing our oversight, and the following week we will begin doing work sessions. It is very, very important that members, and I know you're all serving on other committees, that you're here, because we cannot do work sessions without a quorum. And which means that if we don't get our work completed, then I will move into night sessions. Just to give you a heads up, because the co-chairs have given us some deadlines of getting things completed, and I know that the agencies are trying to meet our schedules. And so it's just really imperative that you're here and you're on time and that you stay. Mr. Tate, thank you for your presentation today. And Monday, I believe we have a long-term care ombudsman that will be up. And if there's no further business for the order, we are adjourned until Monday. Thank you.